A lonely vegetarian sweep you off your feet like a maid Marian having fun. Like a seminarian awake, you say you're a happy Unitarian laughing in the wind like an old Bulgarian. Hey, by the way, are you a librarian?
Hello, this is Deirdre.
And this is Maria.
And this is the Mount Kisco Public Library Podcast. Today we are privileged to have author Mike Mullen visiting the library.
Wait, I thought you were going to call me Fred.
Mike Mullen?
You promised to call me Fred so that when I mispronounced your name, we'd be even.
I like to keep a few advantages.
Do not trust this Deirdre person. She had made a rock-solid commitment before we started this podcast to call me Fred. And now you're calling me Mike. What is up?
Okay. I think we're off on exactly the right foot because Mike just told us in his wonderful presentation that he tells lies for a living.
It's the best job in the world.
Okay. But we are going to talk about various things, and not just truth and the lack of it, but also writing.
And books. And Taekwondo.
Hi-ya!
Awesome. So, Mike, I think that when I read the book, I was under the impression that you were a Taekwondo expert who wanted to incorporate this art into your novel, and I found out something different later, yeah?
Yeah, when I started Ashfall, I realized that the supervolcano would be the worst natural disaster in recorded human history. It'd be a truly horrific natural disaster, and that I needed an exceptional protagonist to be able to survive. I could have made Alex a magician, written something like Harry Potter, or given him superpowers, and written something like I Am Number 4, but I wanted to differentiate my book by making it as intensely realistic as I possibly could. And so I decided that my protagonist, Alex, should be a martial artist. And I was already spending lots and lots of time learning all the geology and studying volcanoes and supervolcanoes, trying to learn enough to be able to write the book. And I just decided that I would prefer to actually do Taekwondo instead of studying it in books. And so I enrolled in martial arts and enjoyed it and stuck with it. And 3 years later, 6 months before Ashfall was released, I finally earned my black belt in Taekwondo. Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Thanks.
And it's certainly a very interesting twist on powers for a hero. So I know Maria has a question she always likes to ask our authors.
So I love to ask authors how they choose names for their characters.
Oh, okay.
So how do you choose names for your characters?
Well, some of the names are from people I know or real people. Like Darren and Joe both live across the street from me, where I live in Indianapolis. And I changed Darren's name, but they're both based on real people. And then Uncle Paul and Carolyn, cousins Max and Anna are all real people too, my brother and his family. And then Alex was named in honor of Ben Alexander, who was a third-degree black belt, 15-year-old I met when I started taking Taekwondo lessons, back when I first started writing Ashfall. Darla, I really have no idea where Darla or Target came from. Those names just must have come somewhere from my subconscious.
Yeah, Target was an interesting one. I mean, well, as a character one, to just the name.
Yeah.
Target.
Right.
I learned something about Target just from talking to Deirdre last night that I never knew before.
Part of what fascinated me about the name as well as the character is that the story, the arc of the story, is definitely a journey like the Odyssey.
Absolutely.
So I was thinking about how a lot of YA authors now are basing their books on Greek mythology or other mythology, and it really struck me that this is very much like the Odyssey, and Target is like the character of Polyphemus, who is a giant who has one eye.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, the Target thing, the tattoo, is symbolic of the eye even before he gets the injury.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other similarities as well. So I wondered how much you consciously used Greek mythology in Ashfall.
I absolutely didn't at all. I had no idea that I'd written Polyphemus into the story. But you're right, I absolutely did. I hadn't read the Odyssey in more than 20 years, and so I reread a little summary of it last night. And Polyphemus must have been lurking in my subconscious somewhere. So.
Yeah, it absolutely is,
and it came
him,
out.
Right?
Yeah, it fits perfectly. I mean, mm-hmm. Cyclops, the eye injury, the whole way in which Odysseus outthinks him, just in a similar manner to mm-hmm. Alex outthinking Target. You know, I never wanted to write a confrontation where Alex beat Target with brute force. I thought it would be better, more interesting if he outthought him. So, yep.
That's very, very interesting. to subconsciously write something into your book without realizing it.
I'm sure it happens a lot.
So we were talking a little bit before we started about music,
mm-hmm.
and you had said someone had asked you what the theme for Asphalt was.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to share what your
answer? Oh, sure. I don't write to music, so I don't have a playlist or anything like that. I do edit to music, though. I always edit to Pandora. And I program in a station that has seed songs, that has bluegrass, heavy metal, and classical seed songs. And my theory is, but by shifting constantly between different genres of music, it'll break my brain out of a rut, and I'll see new stuff in the editing. I don't know if it worked or not. You can read Asphalt and decide for yourself. But no, somebody asked me what the theme song for Asphalt was, and I thought about it for a while, and I decided that it had to be the Overture of 1812 played in reverse. If it were played in reverse, it would start with a bang, end with whimper, and have moments of beauty and chaos in between.
So have you, by that, given away the ending to the book to people who haven't read?
I don't,
ends with a whimper?
Maybe a little.
Should we be scared?
Yes. Yes, it's a scary book. If it gives you nightmares, then I have achieved my goal. I handed it to my mother when only 3 or 4 people had read it. And she read it and said it gave her terrible nightmares. And I thought, yes, I'm a great writer and a terrible son. Because, you know, of course, you don't dream about anything unless you're emotionally engaged with it. So if you dreamt about it, if I gave you nightmares, then I figure I did something right.
This could happen, though, that you would get nightmares. I have read the book. It has moments of beauty. It has moments that really puzzle you, moments that grip you, and definitely some things that will horrify you. So if you want something really interesting with lots of different aspects, then Asphalt is the book for you, I would say.
Thank you. Yeah, that's not, I mean, you know, you don't write anything for everyone. I've had 10-year-olds who've read it after their parents read it and approved it. And, you know, it wouldn't be good for all 10-year-olds. But I've had 10-year-olds who've read it and said it was the best book ever in the history of the earth. And I've had 80-year-olds who've read it and were just horrified. So you could have any reaction in between.
Yes, I think you could. And it's more a matter of personality than of age.
Absolutely.
Yes,
absolutely. I'm not, age recommendations in general make me a little uneasy because I know if I had been prohibited from reading things far beyond my age, it would have cut out more than half of what I read as a child. And, well, I was going to say that I think I turned out pretty well, but on the other hand, I'm now a disreputable YA author, so I can't really say that, can I? Yeah. Using myself as an example wasn't the best plan there.
Well, Mike, maybe it was, because this is something we've discussed with other YA authors, but we really think that some of the best writing going on today is in YA.
Oh, I totally agree. And some of the best writing I've ever read at any time is happening in 2012. I think John Green's new book is his best ever, The Fault in Our Stars. Michael Grant just wrote his best work yet, and he's an awesome author. He wrote Berserk, great, and then Bitter Blue. Bitter Blue is easily Kristen Cashore's best work, and I am a huge Graceling and Fire fan, so that's saying something for me. 2012 is just shaping up to be an epical year in YA literature.
Well, of course, now I have to ask, since you're a Graceling and Fire fan,
oh, yeah.
If you've read one of our favorite series by Megan Whalen-Turner.
Yes, Atolia. Yeah, absolutely. Love it. Especially the way she uses the unreliable narrator at the beginning. Jen, isn't
yes,
it? Yeah.
Yes, Eugenides.
Yeah,
beginning.
Jen is just such a great narrator, and she manages to, I don't know, she managed to fool me through the whole book and yet make the twist at the end completely believable, and that's just so difficult to do. It's just incredibly impressive. So that's what would truly make 2012 the greatest year in literature ever, if we had a new Megan Whalen-Turner, but I don't think it's going to happen.
No, I think she takes her time writing, and myself, I want to live to be 212 in order to read every book that my favorite writers put out, but I want them to have ample time to do whatever they want with the books.
Yeah, yeah, so, and I'm very impressed that she spent 4.5 years on Bitter Blue, although I was not a patient waiter. I started a campaign about a year ago on Twitter, and the idea was that we would raise money to hire a maid for Kristen Cashore so that she could not have to do other stuff and write more. So, and I probably had at least 100 people say they would donate to such a campaign. So, yeah.
Oh, gee, but that's, 100 isn't quite enough, I guess. But
I don't know. It depends on how rich they are.
What a very admirable
one
idea.
One Romney is enough.
Uh-huh.
Depends on which 100.
Yeah. Ah, and speaking of money, I guess I want to get back to your book.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it was interesting. This is a dystopian story that happens in the present day in the United States of America.
Yes.
And certain things, for those of us who remember the hurricane
mm-hmm.
in New Orleans.
Yes.
And the newscasts about it
mm-hmm.
and various other things that have happened like that. How much of it was really based in reality or experience for you?
Well, I mean, all of it, really. I mean, one aspect of the book or the other. As far as the reaction to disaster,
right.
there's a particular book that was very influential, A Paradise Built in Hell by Rebecca Solnit.
Uh-huh.
I highly recommend it if you're interested in disasters, because it doesn't so much focus on the physical reality of natural disasters as the sociological response,
mm-hmm.
the way people mm-hmm. behave in the aftermath of disaster.
Right.
And it was fascinating because you have basically two different responses. When people see themselves as all victims and all common, you know, human beings just doing their best
mm-hmm.
in the face of disaster, sometimes they form these incredible utopian communities, like in the aftermath of the San Francisco earthquake, these free food kitchens formed where everybody brought their food, just gave it, no money was ever charged, and even Chinese people, who were the, you know, untouchables of San
uh-huh.
Francisco society
uh-huh.
then, were allowed to eat for free. The other end of a disaster is when people see victims as other, as foreign, as dangerous. And so
uh-huh.
you have many of these white communities in New Orleans who were spared the flooding, but were in the path where blacks from the lower ninth had to flee. And within 3 days after the disaster, there were in New Orleans, in Hurricane Katrina, there were gangs of whites patrolling their neighborhoods and shooting any black person they saw. And 7 days after...
Is that true, actually?
Yes.
Wow.
It actually is true, because 7 days after the disaster, a group of sheriff's deputies and citizen volunteers lined up on one of the bridges leading away from the Superdome and literally shot into a crowd of over 200 black people who were trying to flee the disaster. So if you see people as other, as dangerous, as a threat, then very quickly you can have issues like that. And so I try to portray both in Asheville. You see these wonderful communities banding together in Worthington and Warren, but yet in the FEMA camps you see the other reaction. What if people in Washington, Chicago, whatnot, see all those refugees as a threat? They're going to come in here and take our food and take our homes. And so the FEMA camp is, it's not a very pleasant experience. And that's based on reality, too.
It was really hard to
read.
That section was hard to read.
If you haven't, read Zaytoon by Dave Eggers.
Oh, right.
And, there's a Katrina survivor who was imprisoned in a 10-by-10 cage for weeks, you know, on the asphalt with no place to sleep, no place to go to the bathroom, insufficient food, in blazing heat. Anyway, so, it's very much based in reality. And then, of course, we can go back to the Japanese internment camps and the Cherokee Trail Tealers. And it's not just like, many people ask me, is that based on the Holocaust? No, it's here. We do that stuff here in the United States. Within the last decade, we've done that. So,
wow. That's amazing to think about in a kind of dismal way. But another thing, and a more positive note for me, is did you notice this, Maria, that there's no descriptors of Darla or Alex, racial descriptors?
I did notice that.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was actually excellent, because then I got to really picture them how I wanted to picture them, and just from their surroundings, what I thought they might look like.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that also lets readers maybe put themselves in their shoes. So
exactly. And that was quite intentional. I mean, I want you to, when you're reading Darla, to think, I am Darla. Or when you're reading Alex, to think, I am Alex. And to completely identify with that character. And I think the more I describe them, it just takes the ability of the reader to do that away. So part of the reason I'm ambivalent about the Hunger Games movie, I love that book. I've read it over and over and over again. And I have this wonderful picture of everybody in the Hunger Games in my head. And I don't know that I really want it replaced by some filmmaker's vision. Although I'm sure it's wonderful and lovely and whatnot. I kind of like my own imagination. Thank you.
Although she's much more specific about how the
characters
look.
And then I try to be more specific when I'm describing the minor characters. Like, you wind
right.
up knowing more about what, say, Mr. and Mrs. Barslow look like than you do Alex or Darla.
Right.
And that's intentional.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So also kind of talking about imagination, I don't know, maybe being from the East Coast, I don't really know, like, Midwest geography that
mm-hmm.
well. But I thought a map could have helped a little bit. You know, How do you feel about that?
I told my publisher, it was interesting because I've been in the process of writing Ash and Winter, the sequel, for a year and a half now. And I got back edits from one of the editors, Lisa Rogiani Bucciari, who's a brilliant editor. But she kept wanting me to add all these explanations of where roads were in relation to her and what was around. And I couldn't really do it because the book is in Alex's point of view, and Alex knows that stuff. It's not like he's going to tell you that because he knows it. And so I felt like she was adding things that would break us out of the character's point of view. And so I actually suggested to Peggy Tierney, my editor at Tanglewood Press, that we just add a map in the front of the book instead, like a fantasy. And I don't know if they're going to do that or not.
I think it's an excellent idea.
I would love it if they did.
Especially when... I don't know if this is a spoiler or not, so maybe we'll put a spoiler alert here. When they
Spoiler alert.
When they started talking about the different...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
It's okay. When they started talking about the different zones, it was hard for me to really imagine like where each zone began and ended, and maybe what the boundaries were.
Right.
Yeah, that would be cool. I'd love a map. I mean, I did add some stuff to help orient to the reader, but if it's a question between clarifying things for the reader or breaking point of view, I'm going to keep doing the point of view and just trust you to keep up. I mean, I'm going to assume that my readers are smart and can stay up with me and, you know, when I'm writing, I'm always trying to write to the smartest reader I know.
I will say I admired how smart Alex was, and until the presentation this afternoon, I didn't realize to what degree it would be difficult to get through that ash. But the skis were brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
And the bike was brilliant, actually.
And that's the thing. Is Alex, although he's tough physically, he is a martial artist. He wins fights with his mind. He outthinks his opponents. I mean, he wouldn't have beaten Target if he just stood there and fought him. And so he didn't. And I thought that was important. I really didn't want to, although I have violence in the book. It is a violent book. I believe that the aftermath of a disaster like that would be, there would be violence. I didn't want him to solve all his problems that way. I wanted to show a more multidimensional character, I guess.
Yes.
And I like, too, how Darla sort of had a complementary intelligence, being so mechanical, which is something Alex sort of, he didn't come across as being quite as mechanical.
Alex is a complete idiot with machines, like me. Alex is me in some ways, and I open the car's hood and I think, wow, there's lots of metal stuff in there. Oh, and there's some rubber things. That's kind of cool. So, yeah, and Darla is very much based on my wife, actually. Not that she can fix cars. I wish. That would be cool. But she's just as tough and just as loyal and just as wonderful a partner as Darla is. So that's why I dedicated the book the way I did for Margaret, my Darla.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Because they do make a very good team, I will say. And we were talking about this, and also my sister Mary, who can't be here with us now, but it's definitely true that when you start reading it, Alex isn't a sympathetic character so much. And Darla, when you first meet her, is kind of the reverse of sympathetic, although she has good reasons. They both do change. And what I was thinking is it's so interesting that he starts off very withdrawn and kind of geeky. And almost an unpleasant young man, would you say?
Sure, that's fair.
And his experiences change him, even though he has to do some horrible things. So why would you say that is, even despite the horrors that he does and endures?
Well, it's in part because of the horrors he endures, right? And I put him in this crucible. And Alex has two choices. He can grow up or he can die.
Right.
And at one point, after he's injured and fleeing, he thinks he's going to die. And he would have died if he hadn't met Darla.
That's true.
And so then they form this team. And partly, I think it's Darla's influence, you know, stabilizing him. And it's very much my wife keeps me on the straight and narrow and level-headed and whatnot. That's very much like Margaret, too. And then it's partly just he has no choice. If he wants to survive, he's got to grow up, and he's got to grow up in a hurry. And I think that's true of kids who are in distress generally. I was amazed. I did this presentation at the Cedar Rapids Juvenile Detention Center to all the, by definition, literally, juvenile delinquents incarcerated there. And it was an awesome presentation because these kids were, they were serious, they were tough, and I got them right. It was a two-hour thing, and they all had to write. I got them all writing. And they wrote these amazing stories. I mean, usually if I go, like, to my wife's classroom, to normal, quote-unquote, kids, you know, they write about whatever computer game they're playing, zombies or something. And then these kids were writing about just deep family problems and issues and working out some of their internal angst in their writing. And I was just amazed and impressed. And I think sometimes difficulties, a tough life, for some people that really does help us to step up and become the men or women that we can be.
Right. But then he's always grappling, and maybe this is part of that. Do you think, Mike, that Alex is grappling with this idea of the other, like when the little girl comes to steal food from him and he almost kills her?
Breaks her arm, yeah. He wouldn't have killed her doing that, but yeah.
Yeah, well, to me it seemed like, oh my God, he's going to kill this child.
Yeah.
But
ooh.
I was quite freaked out, and you give him then an interior process about that.
Yeah. Partly Alex is very much based on myself as a teenager. I had terrible, terrible childhood asthma, and it almost killed me when I was 4 years old. And back when I had it, there weren't inhalers tough enough to deal with the kind of asthma I had. A lot of the modern ones didn't exist. And so the treatment that they prescribed for me, and for 10 or 12 years, I was on steroids.
Wow.
And so I was an incredibly angry young man and boy, constantly in fights, just often, you know, just very violent, very dislikable person I was growing up. And so Alex has had some of that same experience. He's been in fights on and off and defended his sister the one time I recount in the backstory. And
that
he has
a
lot
good
of that
story, yeah.
He has a lot of that rage that I had, that inner rage that just can flash over you in just a moment that I really had to learn to control in my early 20s, or I probably wouldn't be here now. I'd be dead or in jail. And so as I was thinking about this and thinking about Alex's internal characteristics and basing him off myself as a teenager, I realized, you know, the absolute worst thing you can do to someone like that, put him in a position where he has to use violence to survive. And that's the crux of what Alex is dealing with. He has all this rage. He started to learn to control it, started to become a better person, but now he has to let it out. And when is it appropriate to do that? And how do you control it other times? And so you see through the book, Alex often struggling with that question and in fact, using his anger sometimes in really inappropriate ways, ways that make things worse for him, both him and Darla. And you'll see some of that in the second book, in Ashen Winter, too. Alex still has some of those issues to grapple with.
Well, that's great. I think we're going to have to wind up pretty soon. I'd love to talk to you for a lot longer.
Oh,
I'm sure Maria would, too.
I'll hang
out.
We're shutting down the library.
We are shutting down.
They're turning
down
out the lights around us.
Yeah, they are.
That's okay. Let's just hide and see if we get locked in.
Uh-huh.
And then we'll have a sleepover in the library. Are you up for a sleepover in the library, Maria?
I think my cat would appreciate that.
We'll bring your cat down. Then we can cuddle with her cat. I've been catless for 2 weeks, so probably. Although Margaret and I were Skyping, and she picked up the cats and showed them to me.
So
and I
cute.
Have this one, Zippy. Zippy is named for the wild thing, Zippy.
Right,
and,
sure.
Because Zippy is a wild thing. And Zippy found a bee and trapped it and got stung, and his paw was swollen like 3 times. As he had.
Oh.
So we're going to have to change his name to Clubby.
Oh, that's so sad.
And I've heard today that it's cleared up and shrunk back to normal size, and he's okay. So don't worry, no cats were harmed in the telling of this story.
I am so relieved. And that was going to bring me to another question, because there's a lot of great science in the book.
Uh-huh.
So people who like science would really like it. But I wondered about the veterinary stuff, the animals. And one thing that really struck me was Darla and her rabbits and the disease. And also, I'm thinking that rabbits that size can be kind of dangerous, huh?
Yeah, I mean, they can bite, and their bites hurt.
And claw.
But as they get silicosis, they're going to get more and more lethargic. They're going to run huge temperatures.
Right.
They're going to get in their water dishes to try and cool themselves off. And actually, this has been an issue with the Yellowstone supervolcano before. There's this wonderful place, Ashfall Beds, in Ashfall, Nebraska.
Is an Ashfall.
Yeah.
Wow, there's a town.
Basically, what happened is 10.5 million years ago, the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted. And at that time, it was in southern Idaho, because it shifts because of the movement of the plates that make up the Earth's surface. And it dumped more than a foot of ash on Nebraska, over 1,000 miles away. And all these animals, and at that time, that area was a savanna. We had all these hippos and antelope.
Hippos in Nebraska,
yeah,
wow.
We did. We did. We had all these crazy animals that don't exist anymore. And the North American hippo and, and the saber-toothed tigers and different species of antelope that don't exist in North America anymore. And anyway, so they breathed in the ash and they got silicosis, the disease I describe in ash fall.
Right, sure.
And what that does is the ash is microscopic and it's sharp. It's super fine. And it tears up your lungs and then your lungs fill with liquid and you drown.
Oh.
And it also causes, and I don't know the physiology behind this, so follow-up questions that will be referred to an MD.
Sure.
But it does cause a fever, and it also causes the bones to grow these strange little growths, these little lattice-like structures on the surface of bones. And so these fevered animals all charged into the watering hole to cool off.
Down. Yeah.
And so there are hundreds, I think more than 300 skeletons all together, saber-toothed tigers next to their prey, rhinoceroses and hippopotami, and all these crazy animals all crammed into this little watering hole, and then they got covered by ash and entombed and died there. And so skip forward 10 million years, somebody's digging around out there in Nebraska and sees this really cool bone. And now they've built these huge pavilions over it, and they've exposed all these animals in situ so that you can walk through the pavilions and see them all lying there. Really neat. But anyway, that's where the idea, that's some of the research that went into getting the veterinary part of ash fall correct. And then I also wanted to depict things like the way in which Darla kills the rabbit to eat is realistic in a humane way. That's the way that rabbit breeders recommend to kill the rabbit humanely. And they're meat rabbits.
Yeah.
That's what they're for. And then... all the bit about skinning, that comes from my own personal experience. When I was growing up, as a teenager, I was really interested in survival and backcountry living. And so I practiced skinning animals and eating them and, you know, that sort of thing. So I remember that. Wrote about it accurately. And the way I described tanning hides, too, is the correct way to, well, one of the two correct ways to do it. You could read that section on tanning a rabbit hide in ash fall, and if you did it the way I described it, I'm pretty sure you could manage to, you know, do a fair job of it. The pig slaughter thing at the end, I never actually killed a pig. I didn't want to do it just for the book, so I watched a whole bunch of videos of people slaughtering and butchering pigs on YouTube. They have hundreds of them on there. YouTube is so awesome.
YouTube is absolutely amazing, I will say. And you can find other things that might be of interest to you if butchering is not, which still relate to the book, as, for instance, the volcanoes and big band music, which was my next question, but maybe Maria has something
else
to ask.
You can also find there's a video on YouTube of the author breaking concrete bricks with his bare hands. You can find that, too.
I think there is such a thing, yes.
Yeah.
And we will link to that when we put the podcast up.
Cool. Thank you.
All right.
What was the big band music question?
I just noticed that there wasn't much music in Ash Fall itself, except for that one snippet on the radio. And I thought it was very interesting that of all the technology that now exists, the radio was what was still left. I guess that would be partly because radios are easier to operate by battery.
Yep. Absolutely. And shortwave radios, you can receive them with crude and improvised transmitters or antennas if you know what you're doing. And transmitting is not terrifically technically difficult either. So you'll read a lot more about radio technology and specifically shortwave radio in Ash and Winter. I credit in the acknowledgments for Ash and Winter, I thank Ken Bandy, who is the head of the Shortwave Radio Operators something or other club in Indianapolis and spent hours and hours and hours training me how to talk to people in Russia on shortwave radio. It was awesome. And then, spent a lot of time researching that. I seem to spend all my time on Ash and Winter researching radios and guns.
So we get that you're a really big reader.
Mm-hmm.
So if Alex could visit another world, what book would you want him to visit?
What book would I want?
Yeah,
well, I would love
book world.
I'd kind of love to give Alex a break, like, you know, go someplace nice for once. maybe I'd send Alex and Darla together to what's Richard Peck's book about the Chicago World's Fair? A Year Down Yonder.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd send them to that together. Uh-huh. They would love the Chicago World's Fair. They'd have a ball together.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a Darla kind of place to go. And Alex would follow Darla like a puppy dog anyway. So long as I send her along, he'll be happy. But Darla, on the other hand, is not going to follow him around like a puppy dog.
Right.
So we got to go somewhere. Darla, you know, we got to go somewhere Darla's going to be happy. So I'm thinking the Chicago World's Fair is just the place. Darla likes fairs.
Yeah, cool. Very cool.
You grow up in the country in Iowa, and you're going to like fairs. Uh-huh. They just have to. That's the big thing.
It is the big thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess I'll just skip to my final question, although there are 50 million I'd like to ask.
Like I said, we can turn this into a sleepover. I'll talk all night.
I just wondered what you would have to offer by way of advice to young people who are interested in the arts or in writing.
Sure.
What would you say to them?
Before I just answer that, isn't research a weird word? Because, look, if you research, doesn't it imply you failed to find it the first time?
You're searching again.
Yeah.
No.
We should just be called searchers.
But then we would be finders. Like in a John Wayne movie.
Better off you should be called finders.
Well, in some books, that is what we are called.
Or
one of my favorite books about, of course, libraries figure in some of my favorite books, including Megan Whelan Turner's. Hilary Bell, who is a librarian, wrote A Matter of Profit.
I haven't read that. I read, what are her books that have the thief and the prince?
Barcelona.
Yeah, I've read those.
Those are cool, too.
Yeah, those are awesome.
Yeah, those are awesome.
I like Hilary Bell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, what was the question again? I just hijacked. It's like a politician. Hijack your question and go woo off in the distance. I made a gesture there.
Oh, I saw the gesture.
The tangential gesture. I forgot I was on radio or podcast.
That is okay. We could describe it. It was kind of Taekwondo-ish.
It was kind of like a spear hand, except my Master Parker would be upset with that spear hand. It would have to be straight. And then hit somebody there or in the neck or eyes or, Taekwondo is brutal. Taekwondo is brutal if it's done well. So, anyway.
I'll keep that in mind.
Well, do keep it in mind. But I always tell students when I'm teaching them a little bit of Taekwondo, you know, the one other thing you know about Taekwondo is if you get into a fight, you're going to get hurt. So the first thing to do is try to avoid all fights. And that's always my advice. Try to avoid all fights. But if you know your life is at stake, then don't worry about getting hurt and just go all out.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that would be your advice?
Advice for author, young writers. Read a lot. Read a lot. People who say, I want to write, but they don't read, those people just baffle me. I mean, you've got to read a lot. You know, Stephen King talks about reading 80 to 100 novels a year. I've plowed through 170 last year, and I'll probably, probably average 120 or 30 most years. You know, so two or three a week. It's pretty typical for me. Mm-hmm. So read a lot, write a lot, try to write every day. I mean, not all authors do, but most write every day or almost every day. And the reason for that is your subconscious will stay in the story and help you if you keep it in your head. If you quit for a while, then your subconscious starts working on other things, you know. More mundane problems. And then submit or self-publish your work. It's that easy and that hard.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. This was awesome.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me. It was a great event this evening, too.
Yeah, I think all of the kids had a lot of fun and learned.
Yeah.
They did indeed. They did. Yeah, and now they have something new and exciting to read, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So thanks so much for coming to see us, Mike, and Mike's book is Ashfall. You can find it in your local library or bookstore.
Yep.
And definitely read it if you like exciting books.
And the sequel, Ash and Winter, will be out October 8th. So look for that too, please. Okay. Pre-order it now if you wish.
Hey kids, there's a really cool place you can be. It's a lot of fun, yeah, you will see. You can learn a lot about the world that we living in, the public library. The library, the library. It's a place where books are free. The library, the library. It's
sleep's a lot better than watching TV. The section's about almost everything. You'll always find something you're interested in. Plate tectonics or embroidery.